from KQED.
And we've been providing live coverage, special coverage of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals as they hear the case over Proposition 8. They're taking a short break. They'll return to argue the merits, hear the merits of the court in a moment. We're joined now by David Levine. He's professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law. David Levine, we heard a lot of fiery questioning back and forth on this question of standing. They took a whole hour, which is in and of itself unusual, to decide who can really argue this case. Tell us what standing is, why that's so crucial in this particular case.
Sure, Dave. Well, the U.S. Constitution says that cases have to actually be real controversies, technically a case or a controversy. And what that boils down to is that the person who wants to bring a case, and in this case bring an appeal, has to have a proper stake in the outcome, is the phrase that's used. You can't just have an interest in a matter. You can't just be worried about a matter. You have to have some real consequence. And in this case, the proponents of Prop 8 were allowed to intervene in the case at the district court level, but the standard is very, very different there for an appeal. The problem that the proponents have is that the U.S. Supreme Court in the Arizonans for English ruling about 15 years ago, 9-0 in a Justice Ginsburg opinion, said that the Supreme Court had grave doubts that an initiative proponent had that kind of standing to bring an appeal. And as Judge Hawkins mentioned, both he and Judge Reinhart were on the panel that the Ninth Circuit panel that was unanimously reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court on this very matter. So you can imagine they would be very, very gun-shy on that matter.
Let me just interject for a moment, if I might, Professor Levine, because Scott Schaefer, KQED News reporter covering the hearing, is joining us just for a moment. Scott, you've been in the hearing. What struck you about the hearing so far? There was particularly sharp questioning on this question of standing to Robert Tyler, who was representing Imperial County.
There was, and it seems that the person they're representing is not actually the clerk of Imperial County. The judges seemed very uncomfortable about that. She was just somebody, a deputy, who was not acting on the authority of the clerk who's elected in Imperial County. But what I was struck by also, and I'm sure David Levine will get to this later, is how uncomfortable the judges also seemed with the governor and the attorney general declining to defend Prop 8, saying essentially that they were vetoing the will of the people and suggesting that, well, maybe we should ask the California Supreme Court to clarify this question of standing. Do they think that the proponents ought to be able to stand in lieu of state officials if no one else is willing to defend Prop 8? And then the other thing that I was struck by is David Boies, the attorney for these two same-sex couples, acknowledging that the injunction of Judge Walker back in August only applies to Alameda and Los Angeles County. That is something that they have denied when I've asked them about that, because others have made that argument. And so it seems that they're saying, well, this applies only to those two counties and any same-sex couples that want to get married there, and then we'd rely on the governor and the attorney general to tell the rest of the counties, hey, you better also stop enforcing Prop 8.
Scott Schaefer, KQED News. Scott, I know you have to rejoin the hearing and be ready. Otherwise, you'll lose your seat. So we'll let you get back into the hearing so that you can continue to provide coverage. Thanks for giving us that update of what things are like inside the hearing room itself. So, David Levine, on these two points that Scott Schaefer just created for us or rose for us. The question first that Judge Randy Smith rose first before to David Boies, aren't you in a way asking us to kind of ignore the will of the people? Walk us through what he was trying to get at there, do you think?
Sure. Well, if you remember, the initiative process is all about one thing, which is the premise is that there's been a breakdown in the elected representatives, that we're not getting something done by the legislature, by the governor, that the people of California and in the other states that have these kind of initiatives want to have. And so that the premise is that it's an end run around the normal legislative function. And so the idea that the governor and the attorney general, who themselves are part of the problem under that definition, should then be able to put their hands up and say, stop, I don't want this to happen. As Judge Smith put it, they can't directly veto the initiative, but they can indirectly veto it.
And how does that relate to the question of standing? Is it relevant because the attorney general and the governor have declined to participate and the importance of the initiative process and the will of the people as such, is Judge Smith then saying, well, because they've punted the governor and the attorney general, therefore that increases the probability that the Protect Marriage group does have standing?
Well, the logic would go there. And that's why the Ninth Circuit in the Arizona case, Judge Hawkins and Judge Reinhart, went exactly there to say in the situation where we've had a default or a punt by the elected officials, then the sponsors of an initiative ought to be able to step forward. They saw that logic. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court, 9-0 in a Ginsburg opinion, didn't see that logic. But that's what Judge Smith is bumping up against, is that there is an unfairness there, that procedurally this could fall apart on this technicality. But that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said.
And what did you make of Attorney Charles Cooper, again, representing Protect Marriage, the group that's in support of Proposition, making this reference, as Scott Schaefer alluded to at the end, saying, you know, before you dismiss this, you ought to check this out with the California State Supreme Court. What was that about?
Well, it is possible to ask the California Supreme Court questions of state law that might help to resolve a question of federal law in the Ninth Circuit. It's done all the time, maybe a couple times a year. Here's the problem. This is why David Boies was saying, oh, please don't go there. And Chuck Cooper was saying, well, if we have to, let's go there. It will take 2 years to get that resolved. So this case would be put on ice for those 2 years. The stay of Judge Walker's opinion, meaning Prop 8 would be the law of California, would remain in place for all that time. And what David Boies was saying is at the end of the day, we're going to be in the same place again. So it's really kind of this trap that Boies wants to avoid.
Before we get to the other question that Scott raised about whether or not this applies only to the two counties where the original parties came from, Alameda and Los Angeles County, I want to ask you about the question of Imperial County. Robert Tyler represented Imperial County. He was trying to make the argument that it puts their deputy clerk in a tough spot because the deputy clerk isn't sure who she can marry and who she can't. The judges seemed rather skeptical. Did you sense of that argument and whether or not Imperial County itself can participate in this trial?
Well, they didn't focus as much as, let's say, I would have liked it in a second-year law school class on the question of the difference of the standards between intervention and appeal, because the standard on intervention is simply that as a practical matter, your rights might be impaired or impeded. And I can tell you that in other U.S. Supreme Court cases, the Supreme Court has been sensitive to this issue, is that here the clerk would be concerned that they're looking in two different directions. Do I follow state law? Do I follow federal law? I'm worried that I might be held in contempt of court. And so the way you could clarify that would be to allow somebody like this deputy clerk to come in and stand in place of all the others. It is very curious that Mr. Boies and Mr. Olson, who are among the smartest lawyers in the United States, why they didn't try to set up this case in such a way that there'd be no question on that side by essentially deputizing Alameda and Los Angeles County clerks to represent all the clerks.
And again, to clarify what was being talked about when they kept bringing up the question of Alameda and Los Angeles County, the home counties of the parties involved in the case, does that mean then, David Levine, that this case, Judge Walker's ruling, only applies to Los Angeles and Alameda counties?
Well, it would depend on exactly what this panel says about that. Technically speaking, the people who are bound are the parties, but then as Judge Reinhart was saying, is that an injunction does extend beyond that. And the rule of civil procedure says that you would extend it to agents, to employees, and those acting in concert. The question would be, is somebody like this deputy clerk on the one side of the line or the other? And you can see a clerk being very worried, I don't want to be held in contempt of court.
The hearing we expect to resume in just a moment. Before we get there and what they'll take up next, which are the merits of the case, on this question of standing, David Levine, could they rule now? Could they come back into the court and say, well, don't have standing, case over? Or is this something they'll take into consideration and still go forward in this next hour with the argument on the merits?
It's theoretically possible that the three of them could have put their heads together in the chambers behind the courtroom and to reach that result. But in a case of this kind of high profile, the chances of that are about the same as a meteor hitting the Ninth Circuit while we're sitting here.
So they'll hold that in reserve, make a decision about standing later. In the meantime, we're about to hear the argument on the merits. What should we be pointing towards or listening for? Is there a part of Judge Walker's ruling that you think is more vulnerable that the proponents of Proposition 8 will really push on?
Well, I think the core question is whether Judge Walker was right to say that there can only be one definition of marriage and that that definition has to allow any couple of any gender to marry and that it is improper for the people of California to take the position that the President of the United States holds, which is marriage needs to be held out separately from civil unions or domestic partnerships.
Because Judge Walker's ruling was so sweeping and unequivocal, does that make the possibility of challenging it, reversing it, easier or harder?
Well, it's the problem is the strategic game of what do you want to have go up to the U.S. Supreme Court? If you want a big, broad ruling, which is essentially the red flag in front of the bull of the U.S. Supreme Court, then you're going to write something as big and as bold as Judge Walker did. If instead you want to preserve a victory in the sense of saying that Prop 8 is unconstitutional for California, you're going to write something that is narrow and as boring and as technical a standing as you possibly can. So the U.S. Supreme Court will say, another day, not today. We won't take this up.
There's this assumption that this will find its way to the United States Supreme Court. And that is true if indeed this three-judge panel upholds Judge Walker. But if they were to reverse him, it wouldn't necessarily go to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that correct?
Well, it can go to the U.S. Supreme Court in the sense that whoever loses the case today has every right to bring the case to the U.S. Supreme Court and petition to ask them to review the case. And that side would have to get four justices of the Supreme Court to agree that it was time to review the case. But I think if you get a narrow, technical, boring ruling under the Arizona case, then it is much less likely that four justices of the U.S. Supreme Court will be interested enough in the case. If you go the other way, you can bet your bottom dollar that four justices will want to review the case lickety-split.
One of the facets of Judge Walker's opinion focused on this question that his belief was that Proposition 8 represented moral disapproval and that that alone was not a reason for this kind of action. A number of people have made the observation that they feel that Judge Walker was making that argument in part because that would have a particular appeal to Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is likely to be the swing vote on this case. Is that your read as well?
Well, I think that's right, because Justice Kennedy has written two very gay-friendly opinions in his time. He wrote the Romer case, which was referred to already, and he wrote Lawrence versus Texas. Lawrence versus Texas is the case that says that there is a privacy right between consenting adults to not have private sexual behavior criminalized, and that overruled a prior U.S. Supreme Court case, Bowers versus Hardwick. And in the Lawrence case, in fact, the dissent said, you know what's going to be next? Same-sex marriage. So the sense was that if Judge Walker could kind of channel Justice Kennedy's language, that that would indeed appeal to Justice Kennedy, and I think that's probably right. I think if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, if you don't have Justice Kennedy's vote, you sure don't have five votes in favor of knocking down Prop 8.
Give us some sense of what can be challenged and what can't be in this sort of appeal situation. You don't really go over the facts of the case again, right? So what's fair game and what isn't within the bounds of the next phase of this hearing that we're going to hear?
Well, the focus is really going to be primarily, you're right, it's going to be on the legal conclusions that Judge Walker reached regarding the Equal Protection Clause and regarding the Due Process Clause.
And again, those are the fundamental part of this, which is Judge Walker ruled that people were being denied equal justice, equal rights under the law.
Absolutely. Under the 14th Amendment, specifically under federal law. But what also is unusual about this case is that Judge Walker decided to hold this full-blown trial. He thought it was appropriate, unlike most other judges in this context who have really dealt with this as purely as a legal question, he thought it was appropriate to have a full-blown trial, and he allowed both sides, encouraged both sides to bring in expert witnesses, and of course the opponents of Prop 8 brought in a wealth of witnesses to say that there's no rational basis for the distinction between same-sex marriage and traditional marriage. It is a real question as to whether that was a correct legal decision or not, or whether this really needs to be a pure legal matter.
Which was what was what's the question about what would be correct or not?
Well, what would, well, just Judge Walker's whole process is that can he rely on what he wrote as findings of fact on the basis of a handful of professors, a handful of sociologists and history professors and law professors who said there's, in their opinion, the research shows that there's no basis for making the choice that 7 million Californians made.
We're about to resume our coverage of the hearing. The judges have re-entered the courtroom. Everyone is about ready for the court hearing to begin again. This will again focus on the merits of the case.